So hi again, I'm Tom Talpe, architect with the file sharing team in, here at Microsoft. But I'm not actually speaking for Microsoft today. I'm speaking for a protocol initiative that is a bit of a horse of a different color, and I'm going to describe what the initiative is all about, how it's structured, and how we're set to kick it off in basically a couple of weeks. We've got a couple things underway now, and I hope to get this started at the beginning of June. We're going to give it a couple of weeks for everybody to let it soak in. But in any event, it's important that I'm not speaking here for Microsoft, but speaking for a larger external entity. So the problem statement that led us to where we are right now is the SMB2 is considered the file sharing protocol for modern Windows interoperability. It actually goes beyond Windows. Lots of systems speak SMB2 these days. But one thing that SMB2 does not address is POSIX interoperability, is POSIX semantics. To broadly deploy SMB2 on heterogeneous systems really requires addressing the needs of POSIX-oriented systems as well or reasonably well as the SMB2 protocol currently addresses Windows semantics. POSIX is supported by earlier versions of SMB. I'll talk about it in a minute, but there do exist a set of POSIX extensions for SIFS SMB, the earlier generation of SMB protocol. That's a bit of a gap, right, if you will, that SMB was originally a Windows interop protocol, was extended by non-Microsoft processes to address POSIX. SMB2 is a Windows interop protocol and has not yet been extended. So there's this gap, right, of POSIX support in the earlier generation that's not there in the current. There's a second gap, and that is transport encryption. That's not supported by SMB either. Interest here is primarily to avoid having to make the choice with NFS, which does support transport encryption. Right? CURB5P can be negotiated by NFS, and the privacy capability encrypts the transport. Many deployments require an encrypted transport, or at least the possibility of encrypting. And therefore, SMB2 tend to be a second-class choice there because of the non-support. You can encrypt SMB2 by encapsulating with IPsec, but that's if you will, out of band, separate. So our goal, the problem statement that led us to the thing I'm talking about today is really to close these gaps. These are gaps in the SMB2, in the deployed SMB2 support that can be very easily addressed, actually. We believe we have all the tools in the systems, and the protocol can easily be changed to address them. So our goals for the project, to enable SMB to SMB2 heterogeneous migration. Today, non-Windows systems are speaking SMB and do it reasonably successfully. We would like them to move to SMB2 seamlessly or as easily as possible. Second, the goal will be to broaden SMB2 interoperability. SMB2 will be able to be the lingua franca of more machines than just Windows interop. It'll work with Unix interop and possibly even someday Unix to Windows interop. And finally, to strengthen SMB2 security. The lack of transport encryption is a gap in SMB2, and we would like to close that gap by strengthening it. So we want to acknowledge prior work in this space. SNIA, the Storage Networking Industry Association, way back when, in 2002, published a set of extensions from the SIFS Technical Working Group. That technical working group has been gone for many years, but the document continues to live on. You can click that document right off the web. I think it's one link away from that URL. The document, this is SNIA's attempt to standardize the SIFS protocol. Microsoft had published an internet draft called, we call it the Leach-Naik draft. Those were the authors, Paul Leach and Dilip Naik. Back in 1997, it was published in the ITF, and basically didn't go anywhere for various reasons, but it lay dormant, and SIFS was not standard, really, at that point. So SNIA decided to pick up the flag and standardize SIFS. did this primarily by inspecting the protocol, inspecting the prior work. It's an incomplete specification, but nonetheless, it is a legitimate specification of its day. The one thing that it did, which was not, if you will, an investigation of existing SIFS practice, was they created these two extensions called the Unix and the Mac extensions. They are appendices in this technical spec, and they specify a set of protocol extensions to allow Unix and Mac systems to use SMB2. They were published in 2002, March. There were prior draft versions that differed slightly, so the final version, I guess, is as good as it got, haven't been modified since, to my knowledge. So the prior approach, the approach that that document took, was to create a carve-out in the SMB information levels. the carve-out basically reserved values 200 hex to 2FF hex. Only a few were actually used, I think 6, something like that. Then there was basically a payload on the information level, and the extensions were encapsulated in those additional information level payloads. There was also a single bit in the server capabilities that was visible at the initial capability negotiation. CAP under Unix basically advertised that the server had some capability. And there was a related set of Macintosh extensions that had a similar approach. They used 300 through 3FF. I think they only used 3 of those information levels, something like that. There were problems with this approach, lots of problems with this approach. A carve-out is always problematic, right? When you reserve 256 operations and you only define a few of them, and the operations are rather optional and extensible, they really only work between well-matched peers. They're not required. They're negotiated. And in fact, only a subset of them were ever implemented. They're not readily extensible, right? You have to basically go back and rev the spec every time you want to change them. They were guesses at the time, and the process didn't continue, so they're sort of frozen in time. The problems with the carve-out really led to this selective implementation problem, right? One system would solve the problems that it had, and another system would solve the problems it had with using these carve-outs. And, you know, the spec itself, admittedly, said you may not implement them all. This is a quote from the introduction of Appendix D, and I highlighted that last sentence. They may not be implemented by all Unix systems, but they may not be implemented by all the systems that implement them. So it's just this terrible Tower of Babel where no two systems do quite the same thing in quite the same way. And it leads to limited addressing of the needed requirements as well. The spec overloaded some existing offs. Comnt rename had this special flavor called SMBComNT rename. And the carve-out is not extensible to SMB2, which is a totally different protocol, totally different space. The things just don't move forward. So the results of the prior implementation were this mixed implementation support. It was partial or just simply not implemented on many servers. And there was really minimal common feature interoperation. The selective implementation of the information levels was not uniform. So as a result, clients are unable to count on any given server support. They're forced to reduce their expectations to the lowest common denominator, which is basically not present, right? So they had to work, perhaps, when nothing was present. And clients were therefore forced to reduce their functionality guarantees. They couldn't do what they might, what the protocol might have promised that they could do. So it winds up with a very unsatisfactory solution. Nonetheless, it worked, and implementations were created from it. You know, the existing implementations work, and they do what they do reasonably well. But it was an imperfect approach to the problem. So what we're proposing is a new protocol initiative. I first talked about this back at the SMB Plugfest at SNEA in 2009, last year. It was actually discussed many times over the past couple of years by Microsoft and others, and we have finally been able to bring it to the point where we can kick it off. So this is what I'm doing. I gave this presentation, by the way, at Samba XP a couple weeks ago in Germany, And that's not to bless Samba as the only implementer of this, but it was the first opportunity, first public opportunity we had after getting to the point that we can kick this off. So I'm basically kicking it off here with the interest, re-kicking it off. I'm repeating the presentation I gave at SambaXP, with the interest of inspiring more of you to join this effort. It's an open effort. So it's a public collaborative effort to create a new protocol extensions for the SMB2 protocol to support specifically POSIX and UNIX behaviors, and I'll define what those are in a sec. But I want to stress public collaborative, okay? This is an open effort. All can participate. You can participate as individuals. You can participate as companies. We ask that if you do work for a company, that you participate as the company and not as the individual. But it's possible for anybody to join this effort. And it's collaborative. I envision this thing running as basically an open source project. We're going to prepare a protocol, not an implementation. But it's collaborative. We'll be consensus driven, and we'll do what pretty much the consensus recommends. We'll collaborate to create it. I don't actually have a spec right now. I'm not going to bring a spec to the table. There are some proposals already that have come out over the past few years, and we're going to start with those, if anything. It's going to be a lightweight, focused process that's going to draw on the prior extensions and the industry experience in implementing them. Okay, lightweight in that I'm going to have very little overhead. I'm going to impose very little overhead on this thing. There's not really a membership or a vote or anything. It's, as I said, a traditional sort of open source process. And it's focused. We're going to scope it tightly, and we're going to try to stick to the subject. It's going to hopefully not stray very far from what we envision. As a new initiative, I think it's very important that we keep a tight vision on the scope. We'll produce an open published specification that's available for implementation industry-wide. We're going to write a spec, and it's going to be an extension to the existing protocol. And we are structuring the collaborative effort and the content of this specification so that anybody can implement it. I hope that all the participants will be able to implement it over time. It'll obviously take time to do so, but we want this to be implemented, and we want this to be open. I want to stress, however, that the specifications are going to be independent of the Microsoft Open Protocols document set, in particular the MS-SMB2 document. Okay, there are legal requirements that Microsoft has on this document, and we're required to maintain this document in a very specific way. I don't want to tie up these extensions with that process. Only Microsoft should deal with this process. Trust me, you don't want to deal with this process. It is very stringent and very predefined. The format is predefined. I view these extensions as being working from the protocol that we have documented as part of this effort as a base, and to extend it, to have these things be separate from that protocol, but nonetheless in concert with the protocol. If there are implications from the extensions on the protocol, I, as a representative of Microsoft, am willing to address them in the core protocol. Like, for instance, the core protocol may say you must do something, and the extension may want to relax that. So we may be able to relax that language in the core protocol. I don't know yet. I hope that we won't have to do that. I hope that the protocol is structured in such a way that we can extend it while preserving the integrity of the core spec, right, without touching it. But, you know, something will happen, I'm sure. We'll cross that bridge when we come to it. We're not, however, going to merge this stuff back into that core protocol as we start. So a new scope and a new approach. The scope is to support POSIX, and I want to be clear about that. It's POSIX, right? When we call this UNIX extensions, what we define UNIX as being the POSIX semantics. There's more to UNIX than that, but we have to at least simplify the world a little bit and define what we mean. Supporting transport encryption in some form, in some industry standard acceptable form in particular, and we'll have explicit negotiations. So these are the sort of wire visible behaviors that we plan to address in the extensions. The approach may be to use explicit reserved information levels and to explicitly reserve iOctl's FS controls as if needed. I'm not sure what the approach will be, but this is one of the areas where we may be able to carve out some space, but we will define that carve out very carefully. We'll define what we mean to negotiate it, and we will define what we mean to actually support it. We're going to tighten up the requirement, if you will, of the extension. And as I say, they'll be independent of the protocol spec, but they may make reference into the protocol spec. I mean, they almost certainly will. Functional areas are to include the protocol changes, if you will, new capabilities, new operations, etc. But the idea of the protocol changes is to restrict ourselves to the wire visible behavior, right? We're going to make a sharp distinction between what the protocol is and how the protocol is implemented and what functions are actually implemented in the end systems that implement it. To do that, I believe we'll have sort of a server best practice with rules and recommendations. We're not going to require implementation of these things. We're not going to require any particular behaviors on the systems beyond the wire protocol, the wire visible parts of the protocol. Okay? There's room, significant room for innovation here. And I hope that we'll all have our own innovations and that we'll all benefit from each other's innovations. Right? There will be some restrictions made. The character set, reserved characters and reserved names, I view as something that may well feed back to the POSIX requirements. And there may be improvements, protocol relationships, et cetera, to be brought out, particularly the relationships. There's some interesting things going on here. Compare and contrast to NFS, for instance. Compare traditional SMB2 or existing SMB2 behavior with the extended SMB2 behavior. So here's the scope of what I see as wire visible and what we've initially primed the charter for the effort with. Negotiation of this little stars indicate things which are supported by the prior SMB2, SMB/Unix extensions. Negotiation of the server extension by the client, including negotiation of the specific supported items below, whether it's all of them or some of them as a selectable option, I think that's for us to decide as we go. But Does the server support these things, yay or nay, will be explicit at the top. And the encapsulation of the POSIX unit's capabilities, I've defined these capabilities fairly carefully and with the benefit of experience from the prior extensions. File name case sensitivity support, tunneling of POSIX attributes, in particular UID, GID, permission sizes, times, etc. These meanings are really very different between Windows systems and POSIX systems in some very interesting and subtle ways. POSIX file name character set support. Windows supports characters that POSIX doesn't, and vice versa. POSIX semantics on the rename of open files and on the unlink of files. These are really interesting. Semantics on read-only directories. These apparently drive the Mac folks crazy. The read-only directory meaning is very different in Windows from POSIX and from BSD System 5 style behaviors. POSIX file mode set and get. This is just the ability to do chmod and things like that. POSIX file locking. This one's going to be, this is more than it seems. But the wire visible part of the file locking is part of it. Advisory versus mandatory is interesting. POSIX advisory, Windows mandatory. And F-Control-F, full F-Sync. This is the Darwin force user access. This was something that came up in early discussions. I don't know if folks are still interested in it, but it's eligible to be in scope if folks think it's useful. And finally, transport encryption support. Through means TBD. That's obviously not a POSIX issue, but nonetheless in scope. Out of scope. Protocol support not explicitly included above. Okay, if it's not on the list, it's not in scope right now. We can add things to the scope only with unanimous agreement. And the reason for this is that we're asking folks, before they participate, to offer certain rights to the contributions in the end document. And so you need to know what the scope of that end document is going to be in order to agree to those predetermined terms. And so right now we're defining the scope the way I described it and asking folks to agree to that and to sign up. If we change that scope, if we take things off, I guess that's it, that's easy. But if we add things to that scope, everybody's going to have to re-agree, okay? So I want to make it hard to add to the scope. That will help us focus, help us all understand what we signed up for, make sure that we finish what we signed up for, and do it right. Okay? And if we want to add things, if I've forgotten something, or if the process to date or the discussion to date has left something out, let's talk about it. And the sooner the better, before we all, agree. And second out of scope is implementation. This process will produce only a document, only a document. I want folks to implement this, as I said, but we're not going to implement as part of this process, right? That's just completely out of scope. So, yeah, James. Yeah, that's an interesting question. I'll talk about that at the end. The question was, will we require implementation before, quote, ratification of the extensions? Will we try this before we actually commit to it as a final protocol? I'll have some thoughts on that. The project output, it'll produce a specification, which is the document itself. Everybody will see that for years to come, I hope. But it'll also produce a discussion. It'll be an exchange of ideas and experience, right? Experience is very important, in my view, when creating a protocol. And so it will shape the importance of the details. What's the most important thing to do for interoperability? What's less important? Understand the approaches, and in particular, understand the comparisons with NFS. I'm not trying to compete with NFS, but I'm certainly not trying to come up short, right? So the goal here is to understand how we might be compared with NFS as we do this work. I hope to erase the question of, why one or the other. But we'll see if we can get there. And finally, consensus. And consensus is by far and away the most valuable thing that's produced. And that is the community willingness to advance and implement the effort. Right? It doesn't mean anything if people finish the work and say, well, maybe I won't do it. It's consensus is a very strong force in the industry and in human endeavor. I don't want to be too philosophical or poetic about it, but emerging this kind of effort with a consensus is very strong, and it leads to implementations much sooner, things that actually work and things that people actually use. So the project has a structure. There's a project coordinator, and that's me. I take the role, whether folks like it or not. No, I'm kidding. But somebody needs to put the thing together, make sure the structure works, and enforce the regulations. And I've appointed myself. I will do it. But I'm just the coordinator. I'm just the person who more or less makes sure that the process is being followed. The contributors are by far and away the most important piece of it, and I'm recruiting them now. I hope that pretty much all the licensees will be interested, all the Microsoft Open Protocols licensees, Open Specifications licensees will be interested in doing this. And I'm hoping to find others as well. There's a lot of room in here, and it can be quite a broad effort. I'll define a contributor in a minute. And our friends at Ubix Consulting have agreed to be the project administrators, Chris and Jose. We're hosting a website, and the website will have a mailing list and source code control and tracking, issue tracking, and all that kind of thing. So Ubix is going to run a website, and that will be revealed in just a moment. So to be a contributor, there exists a contributors agreement. Companies and or individuals can execute the contributors agreement, and by doing so, they will grant certain rights to their contributions to the project, capital P, project. That's a defined term. I'm not a lawyer, so I'm not going to generalize what those rights are, but the contributors agreement is available on the website that I'll show you in a minute, and you can judge for yourself whether the contributors agreement is acceptable to you. The goal of the contributors agreement is to ensure that the use and the development of the specification are available to all. And that's all contributors. The use of the specification is so that you can read it and use it and understand it and do what you wish with it. The development is that you can actually ship something that implements the specification. And you will know after executing the contributors agreement what your rights are in the result. So that's very important. There's a second phase of the contributors agreement, and that is what happens when the project is considered done. And in effect, we require a second review process at that point, in which everybody will re-review what wound up in the specification and agree that it is, you know, that it meets the scope and meets the requirements that we entered into the agreement with. And at the moment, we're proposing a 45-day period for that final review. If we think that'll be plenty. But in any event, there won't be any surprises in this, right? Everybody will have participated in it going forward. But that sort of final sign-off that we jointly agree to publish this document is an important final step. The contributors agreement is going to be very lightweight. It's going to be click-through. You'll basically register at the website. And to complete the registration, you have to fill in two fields, who you are and who you represent. And you have to agree to the contributors agreement by clicking through. When you do that, you'll basically have a login on the site, and you'll be able to post and send things to it. Without doing that, you'll still be able to monitor the project, still be able to watch the communications and the mailing list, and when we decide to release a document, you know, interim documents, et cetera, they'll all be visible publicly. So you don't have to be a contributor to participate. But if you're going to send anything to the list, this is very much the way IETF works, you must agree to the terms of that communication. So it's lightweight, click through. Commitment that we ask from the contributors is very simple, a willingness to contribute to the specification. Hopefully content, ideas and experience. All right, you give us material. What should the protocol look like? How did previous attempts at this protocol work for you? What do you want to see, you know, the protocol do at the low level? Writing and editing. I'm not going to do it all. We need to write this doc. We need to edit the doc. We need to make sure it's a high-quality doc. We need to review the doc. We need to all agree that the doc is the best we can produce. Contributors will do that work. It'll be a joint effort. Intention to implement is not necessary, though I argue it's pretty exciting. If this protocol does what we think it does, I think there's a big opportunity in it. But you don't have to come in with an intention to implement this protocol. You can decide as time goes on whether you want to implement it in your own way. The structure of the effort, communication, all discussion will take place via an email reflector. We may have face-to-face or conference calls. It's possible that we could do those. I'd like it to be via email. I expect that people will be in many time zones and many you know, agendas, and people will be busy. I don't think this is going to require a hugely focused effort of many hours per week for everybody to get in a room and hash things out. I think that this can easily be handled via email for the overwhelming portion of the discussion. The other advantage of email, by the way, is that it's captured, right? This stuff is captured. We know who contributed what in particular. We know who thinks what, and we can go back and review it. You don't have to be there in real time to review it. You can go back and catch up as the need arises. I think email is the natural way to run this scale of project. There's a wiki-style issues list with work in progress, et cetera. We're basically using standard wiki tools on the we'll be using standard wiki tools on the website. So we'll be able to track issues and make sure that we have we haven't lost anything and keep things going. Every time you post via the email or the wiki, we'll consider them contributions. They may be included in the specification, and that's lowercase may. But, you know, the consensus will choose whether they're included. If nobody says anything, it's not part of the specification, right? So we just remember that when you say things, this is just like the IETF blue sheets. Anything you say can and will be used in this final specification, right? And your contributors agreement granted the rights to do so. So, you know, take this seriously. You can come up with random ideas. We love random ideas, but they may become contributions. Discussions will be open to the public as read-only, as I mentioned. Works in progress, as we're drafting the spec, you know, we're not looking for comments from non-contributors, right? If you want to comment and you want to shape the spec, you need to be a contributor. So I think we'll post works in progress only within the contributors group until we all agree that it's ready for, you know, at least display in a public place. So there will be a little bit of privacy involved here. We'll all know who we each other are, and we'll all keep together on that. But we won't put our day-to-day lives on the bathroom wall. I envision a 6 to 12 month effort here. I think the project is fairly well understood, fairly well scoped. There's experience in the space. I think that 6 to 12 months is a reasonable expectation to do this work. It might be more. It's unlikely to be less, in my view. Very few projects that are collaborative converge in 3 to 6 months, for instance. I want a pretty good review period. So I'm just going to swag it at 6 to 12 months. I'm kicking off the project right here now. There's only one member of the project, and that's me. By June 1st, I hope to have the site up and everybody agreed to the contributors agreement who wants to initially start. I believe we can get going around June 1st. We may delay it a little bit just to make sure that everybody has time to read things through, go through whatever process they may need to do. But, you know, look for it to start in the next month or two in earnest. I don't want to start off with people before we get everybody who wants to be on board. I view the specification development process as happening in the summer and fall. The summer can be a little tricky, right? People go on vacation, etc. So it'll probably have a little bit of a hockey stick shape to it. But the specification, I believe, should be pretty well along by the SNEA event in September. Or at least we know what's going into it, put it that way. So exiting that event, I believe we'll be able to actually create a spec. And by the end of the year, I hope we'll be in significant review phase for the spec. If my 6 to 12 months is roughly accurate, then this is roughly a 6-month period. We'll have at least a fairly skeletal, perhaps, but well-fleshed, well-built spec that we fill in over this time. I view it as being complete around this time next year. Maybe. We'll see. I'll just call it early 2011. Okay? Maybe it'll be the spring. It might be aggressive. It might not. I welcome input. A little bit of food for thought. I didn't want to put up actual work items. I think it's premature to put up actual work items. And I think it's important just to sort of think through at a low level or a moderately low level what problems we'll address in real terms. And so I actually have 3 slides here. 2 of them are lists, and 1 of them is a little bit more philosophical. But these are things which the previous SMB Unix extensions addressed, and things that people have expressed an interest in, and things that I've kind of thought up along the way while thinking some of them through. Unix user ID and group ID, right? Windows doesn't use UIDs, GIDs. How do we standardize those? How do we express Unix mode bits? Symlink support. SMB2 has Symlink support, but are the semantics entirely compatible? This is an open question. I'm not sure. How do we represent special files, devices, pipes, and FIFOs, right? I don't want to do exactly what POSIX does. I want something to make sense to a Windows system that might come across these things. I don't know exactly how. Case-sensitive, case-preserving. Those are POSIX attribute bits for file systems. How do we map those? How do we handle those? How do we address those? Character set. What character set do we use? It's probably not as simple as UTF-8. Things are reserved. There are questions to be answered there. Reserve file names. What are they? How do we reserve them? Access control lists, interoperability. We can payload the access control lists and define, sort of, the access control entries. But what's the true interoperability story? This could be an enormous rat hole. And I don't want to put it on the list for, it's not really wire protocol, right? It's really end node behavior. and the interpretation of these things, in particular the translation from one semantic to another and back. Is it, you know, preserving? If you take a POSIX SACL and migrate it to a Windows system and then bring it back, does it look the same? Probably not. We can at least attempt to define this. I put the word subgroup after this one just because I believe that it's best addressed by interested parties. And I think it's best addressed not in the WIRE protocol, but in a separate practices spec. There are also many existing efforts in this space out there right now. NFSv4 has been going through this for years. Finally gave up in disgust, I guess, because it wouldn't converge. But there are other interested parties here outside of this effort. Probably the biggest one, in my view, locking semantics, advisory versus mandatory. Stacking, do the locks stack or do they merge? If you drop a lock in the middle of a lock, does it split? If you take a lock on adjacent to another lock, does it merge? What happens when locks overlap? What happens when one lock overlaps another one? Define all these semantics which are different between Windows and POSIX. Are they absolute or relative? Can they be signed? What's the behavior on close? Are locks lost on close? Windows locking conflicts with POSIX apps. If you take a POSIX lock, what's the effect on a Windows lock? If you take a Windows lock, what's its effect on a POSIX lock? Particularly interesting when the Windows lock is mandatory. Lock state recovery after transport break. There's probably something interesting in there. Inode number, representing the inode number and other attributes. Extended attributes, right? How do we represent those? Atomicity and replay. I'm worried about this one. In SMB2, the replay problem is focused on one op, basically, or a couple of ops. POSIX semantics may change that somewhat. I think some of the POSIX extensions may have atomicity ramifications. Something to think about. Does it make sense to return explicit POSIX errors from POSIX servers? You know, the heck with translating them. Let's just return them. I don't know. Should we define a new error space for POSIX? Rename delete semantics. Can you delete an open file? What happens? You know, rename semantics. How do POSIX rename semantics interact with Windows rename semantics, basically? The StatFS payload. In my NFS experience, StatFS is a real problematic operation because the block size and cluster size, the interpretation is different between systems. And getting it right, you know, if a Unix user sits down and types df, he kind of expects it to work the same on different systems. And the StatFS payload feeds straight back to that. So defining what that content is, I think, is slightly important. Notify semantics, right? Oplock breaks and notifications. How do they change when POSIX extensions are in effect? Is there going to be a change? I don't know. Another food for thought one. Read-or-write operation semantics with POSIX locking. This is basically mandatory versus advisory. How do the reads and writes behave when locks are encountered, particularly locks outside of the personality that's being done? How do we describe leases? Extended attributes, that's a dupe from the other slide. Should we negotiate these capabilities on a per mount basis or on a per server or per volume basis? I don't know. POSIX flush requirement, restat. I always hate the way POSIX makes you flush pending writes before you return stat. I don't know if that's worth thinking about here or not, but I always hate it. In my experience, HPC apps call stat a lot, and they also have a lot of buffered data, and things really suck when that happens because buffer caches start to flush for minutes at a time just to return the value of a stat. Food for thought number three, this is where I get philosophical. Protocols are forever. It's really, really, really important to get them right. It's easy when you're writing code to do something that is a first attempt and partially addresses the problem. If you got it wrong, well, you can fix the code. You can, you know, maybe deal with some legacy behavior, but it can change, right, is the point when you're writing code. With protocols, you may think they can change, but they can't, because as soon as one system ships speaking that protocol, it may never change, right? It's going to be out there. It becomes a legacy system the day it ships. And it may be out there with that same behavior forever. And so it's really important to get the semantics right. You don't have to do everything, but it's important to get what you've done right. because it's really hard to change later. And you'll have to come up with all kinds of compatibility hooks and issues to support the ones that don't do it as you make up your mind. So I'm going to suggest that the ITF model is a great model here. It's a proven model that develops quality specifications that are actually implemented and interoperable. And the ITF model is very simple. You specify it first, then you implement it, and then you decide if you've specified the right thing, right? You don't finalize the protocol before any implementation exists. You make sure that you've tried it, right? And if you've done stuff that nobody cares about, you take that out. If you've done something that isn't right, you fix it. And you rev that spec before you, if you will, finalize it. Now, this is probably really aggressive to do in 12 months, right? So we may have to be a little bit careful about this one. But I view implementation experience as critical. So that bit about finding contributors who want to implement it is really important to me personally, because I think that'll validate and improve the quality of what we can do if we've at least tried it, started to do this. And this is where I think open source or the open source style of effort brings tremendous value to protocol development, because it allows you to validate that protocol very quickly, right? You get an early window into what kind of a job you did. So I'm looking forward to that. The call to action, watch for the website. It's actually there, but the content is a little bit basic. Oh, good. Chris has updated it. So the content is now not embarrassing, but perhaps still basic. The contributors agreement is there in particular. It's a draft at this point, and both pieces of the contributors agreement are there. The initial piece that you do to become a contributor, and also a draft of the second piece, which is what would be executed when the specification is complete. Okay? Sign up won't happen right away. I want to let this soak for just a little bit. I want to get that started in June, as I said. But very soon, we'll enable that join the project click. And once you sign up, start to contribute. That is our idea. Gordon. I'm sorry, I don't think I quite gathered the question. I thought you were going to say something different, and then you asked the question. Okay. Okay, to support the POSIX access to call, things like that. Okay. So the discussion of things that are missing from the scope can happen basically anytime. I think it's important that they be done as part of the contributors agreement review, because if major portions are missing, then they need to be done before we execute the contributors agreement. So perhaps we can talk about that while we're here, and at least start it, and I can add it to an issues list that we'll all be able to, see. I'm going to move, this presentation is actually also on that site, so we can capture things there, or I can put it on, a wiki page. It is, a little bit my assembly from the previous specs and previous discussions, and if I didn't capture it, I apologize. I think an access check is actually a very good idea, and it's clearly relevant to POSIX, so it meets the requirements, in my view. Okay. James. Do we discuss restricting the scope now or later? I think it's important to discuss it now, but taking things out is easier than putting things in, as I said. Well, yes.
I don't like to make sure it's already in as it could. I don't. Right. They have a explosion or creating leaks, they can stick with that explosion instead of trying to go outside that bounds. What I, as an example, correct, that's
yeah, we don't want to add required behavior to the client. Right. Jeremy.
So yeah, this is something that actually helps.
That's a good point, because there are going to be scope things that reasonable people will disagree on. The ACL one, you saying that we don't need wire changes for that, is one that I think reasonable people, presuming we are, disagree.
Because
I think we do need changes for POSIX ACLs, basically because the mapping that everyone has tried simply doesn't work. No one has ever been able to get a mapping that works. So you do have to have the capability for systems that only want to have POSIX ACLs that are completely separate from NFS V4 or Windows-style ACLs to exchange those over the wire. Having said that, one of the things that we were very careful about when we did the first POSIX extensions was to have essentially a capabilities bit mask that was enormous. It was like 128 bits or more. And what we did was we separated out every possible optional implementation specific thing, and we gave it a bit.
We only defined 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11.
Yeah, we only ended up using 11 bits. But
okay.
At that point, you know, reasonable people will say, we have an ACL model, we don't want this one, can essentially have a way of telling the client when the client inquires on setup time for these extensions, I'm not doing that piece of the spec.
Okay.
And then at least clients know and have the ability to fall back or do whatever it is they need to do in order to cope. And server implementers have the capability to say, that part of the spec's stupid, I'm not implementing it on my system. So, which I think they need.
Okay.
So these are interesting questions, because there'll be obviously categories. There'll be things that we'll disagree about. There'll be things that we'll won't know until we actually implement, and there'll be things that are clearly needed. The list of criteria for inclusion sounds reasonable, but another way to think about that is we have clients. They have a set of interfaces that are required for their POSIX compatibility that's, in a sense, set in stone. There's not much you can do to change macOS core kernel interfaces. There is some flexibility, but I think it's easier to think about, okay, macOS has a fixed set of entry points they have to deal with. Linux has a fixed set. Windows has a fixed set. It's reasonable to assume that. So those clients that have particular needs need capabilities for that. Most of those were addressed in the earlier SIFS extensions, and that brings up the other point, is that things that are, we don't want to regress function from the earlier SIFS extensions if they're obvious.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that you had most of them. So I don't think if we missed one, certainly it should be within scope if there's a previous Unix extension that macOS guys needed that we left off the list by accident. The other example is, clearly, we want to prefer things in the core SMB2 protocol, because those will be optimized by the server guys better. But it's not completely off the table if atomicity or performance, once we actually implement this thing in macOS and Solaris and Linux, shows that, yeah, you really need a separate op for it because of, I mean, the example I was thinking of was there's compounding doesn't guarantee atomicity for certain create, set, adder kinds of combinations.
Absolutely.
And there may be corner cases like that that required, but I'd rather sort of think about that as much lower priority, things that are required for performance. There's another set of things, though, that relates to SFU and SUA, and I'm kind of curious if if there's any sets of sort of POSIX-like things that are worth talking about that SFU and SUA do that are useful for compatibility or necessary for compatibility, so we look like better behaved clients. I mean,
okay.
for example, you can create a symlink in SFU.
Okay.
You could argue that symlinks have their own address space remotely, and we should never care what SFU does. But is there value in thinking about that? Is SFU alive or SUA alive?
Okay.
Does that have to be part of the discussion?
I'm already wired. I definitely don't want to think about this as SFU SUA issues, right? We can't focus on the actual implementations and the behavior of implementations. We need to abstract it to the level of a protocol requirement and a behavior, right? And we can use the prior implementations as examples.
But in terms of those groups, I think it would be a good thing to explicitly invite, if there are engineers still working on that at Microsoft, invite them into the discussion say, hey, if you had your perfect protocol, what would it enable you to do?
Sure.
Because they have they have a different perspective. They had to tunnel all these things over SMB1 without using the Unix extensions. So they should have a different set of perspectives that will be extremely valuable when we're redoing the efforts for SMB2.
And we have to recognize, as implementers, we have to recognize their device pipes, FIFOs. So as implementers, we've got to recognize when we stumble across such an inode that this is a device inode.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so we already have that. But in a sense, I think of that as part of MSSMB2, even though it's a behavior that's it's outside the scope of the protocol, but I sort of think of it as something Windows does. So I don't worry about it.
Okay.
With regard to talking a lot about POSIX per se, is the proposal to have a POSIX conformant specification?
I don't know. What do people want? I doubt it.
Good, good.
I mean, I know how I would answer it, but that's just a personal opinion.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
That's the answer I wanted.
I think it would be extraordinarily challenging to have POSIX conformance, full conformance, as a goal, particularly from all servers that implemented the extensions.
So we're not really talking POSIX per se, we're just talking non-Microsoft.
Encapsulating POSIX features, POSIX semantics, is how I've tried to express it. Right, we're not duplicating POSIX or supporting all of POSIX. We're encapsulating selected semantics.
So, for example, if you specify that the POSIX lock semantics on closing a file apply, I will personally kill you. That shouldn't be in the spec. It's part of POSIX, but clients who need to emulate that can emulate it on the client side without putting it in the protocol. Please.
Okay, well, thanks, everyone. Oh, one more. Sure, go ahead.
Where did transport layer encryption come from? Is it just, it seems like transport layer encryption seems like a generic protocol requirement that Microsoft should do if Microsoft have a
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it?
It's
because, as I said, there's a natural comparison to be made with NFS here, and lots of people, customers, mm-hmm. Developers, systems implementers have all pointed it out. It's just been always on the list as this thing has been discussed.
So let's get Microsoft to implement it as part of SMB2, and then we'll all use it, since I'd like it across the board, right? I mean, we all know that it's needed, right? I assume Microsoft knows it's needed.
We certainly are, yeah.
So I would rather try to push that through Microsoft than through this extension, because it's not going to buy me as much as a client if I can't use it with Microsoft.
Understood.
If Microsoft servers are not supporting it, it's
understood.
Kind of...
And I, as I said at the beginning, I'm not standing up here to speak for Microsoft in this effort. But I will tell you that Microsoft is very interested in this. And it's a bit of, Microsoft is offering it to the community to tell us what to do. So this is your chance, right?
Okay.
Now, you know, when we support it, that's a different discussion that we'll have, okay. Right?
I mean, I think there is a very obvious, very, very obvious thing, is that we had a set of Unix extensions. It would be a very bad thing if moving forward to SMB2, we moved backwards for the Unix clients. So I agree with you that the transport encryption was not really part of a feature necessary for POSIX compatibility, but we don't want to regress. I mean, it would be very bad it would drive me crazy if a customer decided to stay with SIFS simply because, oh, they thought this is a really cool feature. And then lost data integrity, all the reconnect advantages and resilience, just because of transport encryption. So we don't want to regress something that's already out there for the Unix clients.
My concern would be that we come up with something that Microsoft comes up with something that's not compatible with everything.
Yep. I agree.
Sure that we see the existing Unix extensions as a baseline. I think from our point of view, it's already too far. We would like to see fewer.
Let me get into there are issues there, right? I mean, there's several things that happened the way we developed it. I think this is a lot better process. Yeah. I think having everything defined so everybody knows what bits are really have to be implemented and which ones don't, and why if we don't implement this, what the things are, is a very good process. But the one thing I learned in the Unix extensions is if there's something there in the protocol already that does what we need, then we should use it. And also, if we're already simulating something in the protocol and then we add some new call, then we should make sure we at least have it so that those clients that need that extra stuff can get it either and not have to make a whole separate call, which is what I have to do today with Samba. So with non-Mac Sambas, let's put it that way. And so I would like to see, clear, and that's my fault. That part of it was just something I thought we could do on the sly, and we just screwed up. And I don't want to see another screw-up on my part on this again. So I do plan on being heavily involved, but so.
You'll be the voice of simplicity. Good.
But I won't make you implement.
You can do whatever you want with apples. I'm going to use the style apples.
That works
all
for me.
I know.
So George, another way of echoing what you're saying is that if the existing wire protocol supports what we need, but with a different set of processing rules, for instance, on the server, behavior on the server or client, that's a very valuable approach, right? Taking that kind of approach. And it separates the thinking into, how do we request it and what do we actually do, which I think is key to getting this thing implementable. Right.
Thank you very much, Tom.